Hello, and welcome to Distillery Sessions, the podcast from Distillery. I'm your host, Peter Hoffer, and today I'm joined by Stuart Goldsmith. Now, Stu wears many hats. He is a stand-up comedian, a public speaker, and host of the Comedian's Comedian podcast. Now, chances are, if you have a favorite comedian, Stu has probably interviewed them. So, Stuart, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
No, my pleasure. It's, I'm quite excited to get your views on comedy, what goes on behind the scenes, how it relates to fans. So, yes, I'm definitely looking forward to this. So maybe to kick us off, could you sort of introduce yourself and sort of your path to comedy?
Certainly, yeah. So I've been doing stand-up for about 15 years now. And before that, for 10 years, I was a street performer. So I used to work in Covent Garden, and I used to do street shows, circus shows outside. And then I would go up. I kind of got into that when I was, I sort of became excited about that when I was a teenager. And so I would go up to the Edinburgh Festival every year, which is the biggest open access arts festival in the world. And I went there when I was maybe 16 or 17, and it really unpeeled my mind. And so I would then go up there every summer doing decreasingly rubbish street shows as I got better and better. And I would take the money I earned from the street shows and then go and buy tickets for all the comedy shows. So that's how I then became hooked on comedy and realized that much as I love street performing and I love that kind of immediate relationship with, you know, I love the kind of the heroism involved in taking an empty street and turning it into a crowd. And we in those days, we were crowdfunding and crowdsourcing before those terms existed. I did that for a while and realized that I was more excited about a different type of risk. So then I started doing stand-up, and then about 8 years ago, whilst I was a stand-up comedian, I realized that I'd never done any official training in it. You know, there's the odd comedy course to get you from zero to starting, but I'd never done one of those. And there weren't really any resources apart from that at all. And so I sort of thought I spent a lot of my life training and practicing for various kind of careers, and now I'm in stand-up, and I've never trained. So I wanted to... create. I suppose the original idea for my podcast was to kind of hire a comedian whose work I really respected and say, look, if I can get 10 other comics of my level together and we all put some money in, can we pay you to give us a masterclass? And no one would take me up on it. But I don't think so much people were sort of jealously guarding their comedy secrets. There was no culture of that within comedy. So I started interviewing people specifically about their career, their process, their development. And then it became over the years that often their mental health comes into it as well. I'm always sort of asking, how do you cope with being an artist? How do you cope with creativity? What processes have you found throughout your career to identify and to try to overcome a lot of the creative challenges that we face? Because I think comedians in particular are... we're the most vulnerable person in the room as well as the most powerful person in the room. So the idea of how we apply ourselves to creative challenges in very heightened situations is endlessly fascinating to me. So I've been doing that podcast now for 8 years with over 330 episodes with some of the best comics in the world. And that's what I do now. So I'm a touring comedian, although not right now, although I'm pleased to say, and this is the first time this has come up in an interview, 2 days ago, I headlined the UK's first live stand-up comedy gig after the pandemic. There have been a couple which have been done with like drive-through with audiences in cars, yes. But this was not. This was in an outdoor space with a bit of canvas over the top of it to protect from rain. And there must have been 100 people there. It was all temperature checks on entry and deeply sanitized. And so I think I might have made a tiny piece of comedy history there by being the first one back in the UK. I tour, I do stand-up shows everywhere, and I do the podcast and other things besides. I did warn you, you're only going to need to ask me two questions because I will not talk, so interrupt at any point.
Well, with the as you mentioned with the podcast, I think one, you know, the major standout of, you know, the Comedian's Comedian podcast is, you know, while other comedy podcasts, it's, you know, sharing jokes, sharing banter with yours, it's, you know, you're not afraid to talk about the sort of meaty issues. I think, you know, your most recent podcast with Archie Maddox, I think, where you talked about Black Lives Matter, Grenfell Tower, and you've also tackled, you know, topics of gender and sexuality. I think it's is tackling those issues quite vital in order to understand what goes on behind crafting comedy?
Well, it can be. I never want to get someone on the podcast and make them the spokesperson for a particular ethnicity or a particular gender group or community to which they belong. But I think the thing that differentiates my podcast from a lot of them, even in the space, even in the much more niche space of podcasts about comedy rather than which are inherently funny, is that I'm good at listening. You wouldn't know it, but I'm good at listening. And I think part of the reason the podcast developed as it did is because I was very frustrated at the number of interviews I would do, promotional interviews for shows and tours I was doing, in which I would be asked things that had no real desire for insight. They had no real kind of, they weren't voracious interviews. They were like, hey, what are you doing? What's up? Hey, where'd you get your ideas from?
Yeah.
And I just felt like we are artists and we have so much more to contribute than that. So the skill I developed was really to ask provocative questions and then listen, and almost, you know, like a used car salesman wanting to make a sale, they'll just be quiet at you until you feel compelled to fill the void. Well, I've kind of adapted that. So I try to give people, I try to challenge people on their preconceptions of themselves. And then I just try to listen deeply and do good listening eyes. And then they keep filling the space. And then we get, for me, the kind of the manner is where we, the really good stuff is when I can tell people are saying things that they either haven't said before in interview, or they're saying things which they are only just realizing as they say them. Mm. Those are the most kind of exciting moments for me.
Yeah, no, that, I think that's, and as a listener for the podcast, that's where, you know, perhaps the performer is, you know, trust you to put down his or her guard.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Yeah. So, you know, you've had hundreds of episodes with this podcast. What are the biggest misconceptions you think when it comes to comedians?
I think well, there is a misconception of comedians, which is that anyone at all cares about us. I think we like any industry, think that our industry awards are important and that our industry is kind of recognized in a way that it's, most people don't really, you know, most people can name five of the biggest comedians if pushed. But I think insofar as the general public has a conception of what comedy is, one of the things that most frustrates me is when people invoke the idea of the tears of a clown. It's a wonderful narrative piece of imagery to go, oh, the person who is out there entertaining everyone inside deeply, you know, they're deeply flawed. Of course, that has been the case with very many famous comedians. But I think the thing is, everybody is deeply flawed inside, and everybody has struggles of one sort or another with their mental health. And it's simply that our job is to talk about the things we're thinking. So I'm sure that any industry you care to name is as riven with anxiety and envy and depression and imposter syndrome and all of those things. It's just that you don't really have an outlet in most people's line of work to actually express those things. Whereas we do act as a sort of a societal pressure valve, whereby a comedian can go on stage and talk about having been sexually abused or having been deeply envious of someone in their career, or sort of all the awful things that can happen to people that we are societally encouraged to either keep to yourself or put to one side and get on with your job. Well, our job is to ruminate on and explore and get into the guts of those feelings. And I think that's part of why comedy is so important for culture.
You mentioned that you know, many of us deal with these issues of anxiety or imposter syndrome, but what is it about a comedian that you know, pushes him or herself onto that stage in order to you know, articulate these feelings?
In short form, I think most of us are either running away from something or running to something. A lot of very driven comedians, because the job is hard, and to achieve a basic level of success, to achieve a basic ability to pay your bills as a professional comedian is phenomenally difficult and requires a real commitment to and putting yourself through boot camp for a good number of years, driving, you know, often holding down a regular job at the same time. And I'm talking outside of normal pandemic situations, of course, but you might well be working a 9-to-5 job or more and then getting in your car and driving a 300-mile round trip to work for free simply to get the stage time. And that can go on for a long time. So the commitment required is really enormous just to get to what I think of as kind of base camp.
Yes.
I have forgotten the question, would you believe?
I guess, you know, what
drives people? Well, I was talking about road. That's it. So, sorry, my point was, and I'll allow you to edit this neatly if you like, or to reveal my ineptitude by leaving it in. And I think that commitment reveals is often most deeply revealed when someone is trying to. There's a comedian called Ed Byrne. Most of his excellent material is him trying to win arguments that he lost at the time. He picks over things. Similarly, some people are trying to impress their parents. Some people are desperate to, and these are quite, you know, deep. These aren't things that are necessarily on the surface, but my podcast in particular goes to these places. Some people are trying to, well, you mentioned the Archie Maddox one. He's the most normal member of his family because they're all flighty artists and actors. So him being, he's kind of a black sheep of the family by the virtue of the fact that he is merely a comedian. And there's another friend of mine, a brilliant comic, Amy Haverska, who is the only member of her living family who is not a world record holding skydiver. She's a comedian. So it can be anything from the kind of the classic version. And a lot of comics have versions of these identities where you weren't the funniest kid in your class. You were the second funniest and it killed you, you know, or you were in danger of being bullied. And so you managed to control the way in which you were laughed at. You know, you like often comedy is a manner of controlling the way in which we're laughed at. People manage to do that to avoid being bullied, those kind of things. And those can have very, very, they can turbocharge a career, those kind of things. They can't necessarily turbocharge a balanced mental state and a sort of a career filled with happiness. I think a lot of people in comedy, as in business, I know, are constantly seeking the next thing. The biggest comedian you name, they want the next thing. They want the next thing. They want to be in movies. And if they're in movies, they want to be a leading man or a leading lady in movies. You know, it's that drive for stardom is often incompatible with a healthily balanced internal life. So I think what, in answer to your question, what element of the psychology pushes people towards greatness? Well, it may well be like people who become great athletes. If you want to win so much so that you are prepared to put yourself through enormous physical hardships, and in our case, you know, dignity-related hardships as well, then it's often because you are being driven by something that is beyond your control.
Now, with you know, the intense drive for comedians, we're facing a big speed bump at the moment, the pandemic.
Absolutely.
Down. So just firstly, how are you managing during this lockdown?
Well, thank you. I'm doing pretty good now. I think those of my colleagues who already have podcasts, we hit the ground running because we have a very I have cultivated a really good relationship with my fan base. I don't like calling them the fan base, the listenership of my podcast. And remember, with me, it's like a unique quirk of my job, of my particular career within comedy, is that I have a lot of fans of my podcast on which I am not necessarily funny. And part of my job, I realized a few years ago, was to convert them into coming to see me do stand-up. And it's bittersweet that often people come and see me do a stand-up show and I come out and I see them afterwards. I'm selling merch or meeting people afterwards and they'll say something like, I've been listening to the podcast for 5 years. I had no idea you were that good. I'm like, yes, okay, thank you. Good. That's a conversion. You know what I mean? But like, I know I'm good. And I have in the past, I think I've made the mistake of being too British and too self-deprecating about my ability on the show. So those of us who are podcasters who have a very good, like a very sticky engagement with our audience, hit the ground running. So I very quickly in week not even week two, I was exploring other ways to make comedy online.
Mm-hmm.
And whilst a lot of people were kind of doing comedy into webcams, I knew that that felt, I jumped on one of the first gigs I could get with those that someone else was running, and I came away from it feeling like, well, I hated that. And yeah, the audience probably thought it was fine. But the essential component of comedy, the audience, is missing. You don't have a back and forth relationship with them. So then I went nuts for 3 or 4 weeks trying to create a version of an online gig in which the comedian would get the sort of reciprocal, the kind of feedback that we need such that we relax and enjoy ourselves and aren't simply reciting a script into the void. So what we've finally, I mean, after numerous iterations, what we've settled on now is 12 members of the public in a Zoom room or a Google Hangouts type room, which is then streamed to Twitch. So there's loads of different options, but yep, that's the model of it that I'm doing. So I'm now doing an online chat show called The Infinite Sofa every Monday at 9 on Twitch. That has its own issues because Twitch is a big stumbling block for people. People haven't heard of it, or if they have, they associate it with teenage gamers. All it is a platform like YouTube, which has numerous other bells and whistles and opportunities for interaction and monetization. So we want to embed that. We've embedded that in a website, infinitesofa.com, so that we never need to say Twitch when we're talking to people about it, so that we don't scare people off. So sure, we do The Infinite Sofa on a Monday. On Tuesday, we use the same technological approach to do an online comedy show called Chops, which is new material. So comics try new material. But again, it's to people that they can see and people they can interact with. And then I've been doing numerous other kind of attempts to explore it. I've been mentoring people online. I'm in the lucky position of having a decent sized audience who appreciate the way I think about comedy. So it's a hop, skip and a jump for me to start mentoring people or working on people's jokes or their act or their career. I mean, with me, it's less working on their jokes and more working on their, trying to almost do a mini version of my podcast to newer comics to work out what's creatively blocking them and how I can help them overcome it. So I'm lucky, but I've also made a lot of luck for myself by really seizing the opportunity. And a lot of that has been driven by excitement and fear, having a gig, you know, a year's worth of gigs booked that then just all vanished, or that it got postponed and then postponed and then postponed again, and you're like, that's never going to happen.
Sure.
So I realize now, looking back, that period, that first 2 months, was probably quite manic. And I'm a parent of 2 children as well, and we have no childcare. So I was leaning very heavily on my partner for that. And I kind of changed gear a few times now. And I think we're on a fairly even keel whereby I'm being productive whilst also not being a terrible co-parent.
Now, so it sounds like it's not just adapting, you know, finding the right technology, but it's also, I guess, adapting sort of performance style that you know, you're not relying on that back and forth with the audience and the live audience. It's, you know, I guess having to find perhaps a new skill set when it comes to sharing these.
Yes, I think so. The chat show that I do sometimes runs to 2 hours, and I'm hosting the whole thing. It's sort of almost a combination of the Graham Norton show and Gogglebox because it has this kind of interactive element. But I'm streaming for 2 hours, and even though I have guests and other things, I'm helming, I'm steering that ship for 2 hours, and it takes a lot out of you. And I have had to learn to do a different version of myself. In many ways, it's been a really educational experience, because you constantly, as a comic, you learn about your, what we call your voice in comedy. You learn about that by putting yourself in danger and seeing how you honestly react. And so it's almost like if someone does a radio show, if you're recording 4 hours of radio every week, by episode 100, you can't really hide yourself anymore. You are nakedly there and you just reacting very vividly and presently. So that has been, a version of that has been happening with my streaming work, which has been, it's been really fun. It's satisfied a lot of, not all of, but a lot of my craving for dopamine, you know, all those things. Like, I've been a performer now for 25 years. So when I went back to this gig on Tuesday, I realized that break is the longest break I've had from performing in 25 years, which is an astonishing kind of, it is a very visceral, physical reaction to be there in front of a crowd. The streaming shows, the online shows, have satisfied some of that urge. And also, so it's been fun, but it's also been, it's allowed me to replace one obsession with another. So it has ultimately been very good for my mental health, because I have been able to spend my days going, right, we'll do this with a mailing list and then we'll retarget some ads to try and get people there. I'll book these comedians and now we script the show on Twitch at 11 o'clock on the morning of show night. So then the audience actually helped me write the show that they're going to come back and watch that evening. I've not heard of anyone doing that. So the pretentious analogy I came up with in week one was that we're building in space. So if you build a rocket to get to space, it has to be aerodynamic. It has to be able to leave the atmosphere. If you're already in space when you start building your spaceship, it doesn't need to look anything like a rocket. So we're in this new, completely uncharted area. So I don't need to make an internet show that's a bit like a TV show.
Yes.
It's an internet show. It can look like anything. It can be anything. It can. The show's called The Infinite Sofa. A friend of mine cheekily suggested, is it possible that it could always be on? And that really set me thinking it could actually be infinite. I could do shifts as a presenter. We could, you know, we could make it such that the show is always happening, which is, if I didn't have children, I would definitely have tried it for a week. But, you know, so there are limits. There are elements of my life in which I still need to leave Earth's atmosphere. one of them is parenting.
Are there any comedians that have particularly stood out during this, this lockdown that that you've perhaps discovered online or just really up their game when it comes to?
Yeah, I don't know so much. I think upping their game is a sort of a potentially dangerous term because I don't mean it in a pejorative way, but I think that some of us have been able to pivot as I have.
Yep.
And some of us have been able to put greater or lesser amounts of work into that because of shielding relatives or doing childcare. A lot of comics I've known, have had their financial situation is so precarious. They were so wholly reliant on live work that then disappeared that they've had to get jobs in supermarkets, which I'm really proud of them for doing that and not kind of clinging on and trying to avoid it. I do think I understand the question you're asking, though, which is about people who have pivoted most successfully. I think probably my favorite example is Bilal Zafar, who is a stand-up comic, and he's been on Twitch, and he's very cleverly melded. It's almost like I'm trying to use Twitch to my own ends, whereas he's trying to use Twitch for what Twitch is designed for, plus his own ends. So he's playing, and I don't even know, is it like FIFA 2005 or 2050? I have no idea. I don't know about sport games. But he's playing a football management game, but he's also embodying the characters. He's doing post-match interviews with himself in character. He's improvising. I mean, I could see you laughing. It's a funny idea, you know? And he's just making almost like a completely three-dimensional football manager sketch show, which again is infinitely long. He plays it whatever he wants for as long as he wants. And he finishes a match and then puts on the tie, looks in a different camera and does an interview. And because he's very funny and a very funny improvisational comic, it's going through the roof because everyone that discovers it goes, I get what this is. And, you know, it's almost like one of those dream elevator pitches where you go, there we go, that's what the concept is. And everyone's just magnetically attracted to it. So he's doing really, really well. There are plenty of people working as hard or harder who have not yet managed to be the thing that catches fire. But again, that business analogy, I think comics are a lot like startups.
Yeah.
And it's just you against the world. It's you and your idea and your self-belief and how much of that you can hang on to in the face of overwhelming opposite opinion from, you know, people telling you it'll never work and trying to carve out that niche. And just like startups, some of them catch fire. Some people invent a thing. And then the people that make use of that, the people that stand on the shoulders of that are the ones that become mega famous. You know, it's a complete parallel to the world of startups, I think. But Bilal, I think, is like, I can imagine me describing this and your listeners, a certain portion of your listeners going, I'll check that out. Because it has that kind of simplicity of concept.
Yes. No, I think it's, through diverse events, people will find a way. There is that you can't really stop the drive when it comes to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm just looking, and forgive me, my attention wasn't wandering. It's twitch.tv/ZafarCakes. So ZafarCakes, ZafarCakes is his Twitch channel. So I would direct people there, or even put it in the show notes or something, because it's such a perfect example of exactly the things we're talking about.
No, I think That's something I will definitely check out after we record this. Yeah. Now you mentioned a couple times of going back sort of on stage through back to live performance. So, you know, waiting backstage the 5 minutes before you come on, what was going through your mind?
Well, in all honesty, most of it was me wondering whether I would A, remember my act, because I don't really write my act down. When I write jokes, I tease ideas apart and then make notes. And beforehand, I was looking at my notes and thinking, Velcro/hat/drown. What is that? Like, what is that? Because that would have been something that probably occurred to me one gig. I said it that night. I listened back to the recording. I said it the next night. I tweaked it and suddenly it was a bit. But it's not anything I properly made a note of. So there was a certain amount of fear about not just remembering the act, but also one of the things I was aware of is that some of my act is preoccupied with, how can I put this? The show I was writing at the time,
yes,
which was for the Edinburgh Festival, which is now not happening in a month. I mean, on any other year, the 9th of July, me and every other comic would be sweating going, oh my God, the Edinburgh Festival's coming up, and, you know. And now it's just so peculiar to have this kind of creative space because I'm not panicking. But that show was going to be about trauma. And so some of the material I have, which is funny and relatable, has at its core some pretty dark stuff. And I was thinking, if I go on stage and I start a bit, am I going to realize halfway through that this bit alludes to death or alludes to chaos or trauma? In a way that simply won't be palatable now because those things are in the forefront of everyone's mind. I have a very, it was almost an opening joke, which is an offhand reference to, an offhand reference to, shall we say, a family tragedy.
Yeah.
If I were, it's in a comedy club or a touring show, it stands out and it works because it's juxtaposed with sort of a very warm-hearted energy. To tell that joke under these circumstances where people have lost people because of the pandemic, the context is just different. Yes. And that is a point not simply for that joke or for what I might accidentally say on stage, but I think in the days before doing that first live gig, I was very keenly aware that my role as a comedian, the attitude that a comedian takes is you walk on stage and you say, this is my house. This is my house. This is my context. This belongs to me. I'm the most powerful person here, but I get it. I remember Bob Mills, brilliant British comic, used to do the show In Bed With Me Dinner on Channel 4. Bob Mills once, he got a little opening gag of his many years ago. I hosted the night. I did a really good night. I was a younger comic, and he's sort of much more veteran than I am, much more experienced. He walked on, he said, that compere, give that guy a round of applause. I tell you what, in a year from now, you're not going to be able to afford a ticket to see that guy. And everyone cheered. And he said, I'll tell you why, because you're not going to have jobs anymore. Because it was at the heart of the financial crash. So that sort of a joke is predicated on his understanding of the context. That joke is apparently one thing, but the bait and switch, you know, the sort of the right-hand turn it takes, is that he's suddenly juxtaposing what's going on now with what's going on in our wider life, in our wider context. That's why it's so successful. And the really good comics have got a really good sense of what the man in the street, what the person, the woman in the audience is worried about, that they don't know what they're worried about. You know, the things they've observed that they haven't noticed they're observing. That's the basis of observational comedy. So what I found is that because the pandemic, or what I was concerned about, is that because the pandemic has affected everybody in such radically different ways, from people who are in their 20s who have been going, God, there's nothing left to watch on Netflix, to people who are parents of young children who are tearing their hair out going, I can't homeschool anymore, this is awful, to older people who haven't seen another human being for 3 months. I felt like, what is the shared context? That, for me, that bedrock of understanding who you are and who I am and how we relate to one another is completely exploded now. That's up in the air.
Sure. No, it sounds like it's you along with other comedians having to recalibrate that, you know, the mood, the feeling, the appetite of the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Because comedy is not always, is rarely simply a person on stage telling some jokes apropos of nothing. If you're a one-liner comic and you go, here are 30 one-liners, and it's immaterial what they are, you know, that's brilliant. I absolutely love those jokes. I wish I could write them. But most comics, I would say, have a sense of the back and forth between the crowd.
Yeah.
And that is, my fear was that that would be fundamentally altered. In the event, I had a fantastic show. And with just, I did some prep for it. I listened back to recordings of other gigs as I was walking around beforehand. And in the event, I was able to sort of seize control of it, because despite what my psyche might constantly tell me, I'm a very experienced and competent comedian. So I was able to do the job. But that was the fear for me going on, much more so than the idea of going out and having to be funny, which I'm pretty much used to that fear. That doesn't really crop up.
Look, could you talk us through more about the role of the audience for a comedian when, you know, crafting his or her set? Because, you know, as you mentioned, in a normal year, next month, you know, almost every comedian will be up in Edinburgh, and in July, it's a lot of work in progress at, you know, clubs across the country. So can you talk us through a bit about the role of the audience?
Sure. I think for most, let's use Edinburgh and that kind of annual model, as opposed to, say, a touring comic who's going to do arenas and might build their show differently because they're building towards a big arena show. But just the kind of the mid-level, the vast majority of working comedians.
Sure.
The Edinburgh Festival takes place in August. And on September the 1st, you effectively burn all your old material and go, right, I've got to do it again in a year. So I've now got, the clock is ticking. I've got 11 months until I do this. Now, if you're sensible, you might say, I'll have September off and I'll start worrying on the 1st of October. But everyone has some version of that calendar whereby you're doing previews in February. The Leicester Comedy Festival takes place at the end of February. And most British comics are thinking, oh, I should probably have something together by Leicester. And then the clock's really ticking, because then someone has a banger of a gig at Leicester and everyone talks about it. You're like, my God, they're already ready. And we're like anyone. We're all like, it's like we're at school and we're all going, oh, guys, I haven't done my revision. You know what I mean? And then they walk on and do something. You're like, you've done your revision. So there is the ordinary shape of the year. Now, I am prone to anxiety myself and have always had a problem with, I remember thinking very early on in my comedy career, oh, God, I've got homework forever. Now I've got homework forever. Now someone else, another comic, might have said, this is great, I can write whenever I like. But I was always very much that type of comic who needed to write in order to be able to perform, rather than the other way around. So a few years into I was going to do my ninth hour of stand-up this year, so a few years into, like, maybe hour three or four, I thought, I can't commit the rest of my life to panicking from September to July every year. That's no kind of a lot. So I personally started to do one or two things to kind of seize control of it rather than be beholden to that normal calendar. So one of the things I did a few years ago was I treated Leicester as an opportunity. I thought, I am going to write jokes only on the morning of my show in Leicester. And I'm going to perform those jokes and I'm going to be completely upfront about it. But from September to February, I'm not going to write a single new joke. I'm just going to live, experience the world. And if something strikes me as funny, I'll make a note of it. And so on the morning of the 22nd of February, 2018, I sat down and went, right, I've got a show in 4 hours. I've got a big bunch of notes. Suddenly all of them look absolute nonsense. None of them are funny. What am I going to do? But I have to. I've kind of manufactured a state of creative crisis. Like, I've got 4 hours and I have to go and do an hour. And I did it and I got away with it. It wasn't brilliant, but I proved to myself that it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that then kind of dovetailed with a thing that I'd been doing for a couple of years previously. When I go on tour, I'll do maybe a 25 to 35 date tour each year. And most comics, when they tour, will do half an hour of, if they have a support act, they'll have a support act in the first half. I'm not quite at that level yet. The margins don't work in my favor. So what I would ordinarily do, someone in my position would do 30 to 40 minutes of local material, crowd work, and a couple of new bits, then an interval, and then come back and do 45 minutes. And that's the show. That's the bit that they've been, you know, practicing, rehearsing. I wanted to do it the other way around. Initially, because my material is so personal and autobiographical, it wouldn't make sense for me to do jokes in the first half, new jokes about what it's like to have a one-year-old. And then in the second half, do jokes about being an expectant dad. That didn't make any sense. So, So what I started doing was I would do the show in the first half. I'd go, here we go, an hour straight through. That's the show. And then at the interval, I'd say, you've had the show. I'm now confident that you've had your money's worth. I hope you'll come back after the interval. I'm going to do 40 minutes to an hour of really new stuff. And again, it would put me in that creative crisis whereby I would need to fly by the seat of my pants. These people like me. They've enjoyed it. They've had their money's worth, in inverted commas. And they're warm. They've had a drink. They've settled in. They trust me. But now I'm going to go out there with some bits of notes on bits of paper, and I'm just going to wing it and freefall. And the reason I've maintained doing that, pursued doing that, because for me, that's a very creative place to be. Absolutely not the same for everyone. Some comics literally write, type out the show and then learn it and perform it. I'm not like that at all. So, yeah, so I put those two things together, basically, and it allowed me to kind of seize control of the creative process, whereby last year at Edinburgh, I did a work in progress show, which changed every single day. So I would write every day and I would turn material over every day, and it was different every single day. So yeah, so that's a very long answer again, but that's my approach to kind of trying to take control of it myself, because there are so many variables, you might as well control the controllables.
Sure. No, it's really fascinating just to hear, you know, what goes on under the car hood when it comes to crafting the comedy. So when you're on stage, what are you listening for? What are you trying to sense from the audience when you are trying out new material? Is it, you know, not just that a laugh, but is it a quality of the laugh? Is it, you know, the time it takes for the audience to follow?
It's all of those things can come into it. Some of my favorite jokes are ones where you leave a thing unsaid and the audience catches up in their own time. That's a very satisfying laugh. In the show I did, the work in progress I did in Edinburgh last year, I was using a PowerPoint presentation, but it was literally 50 words in white on a black background. And that was my notebook, because every day I was writing stuff and putting new words out there and changing it. And there was one moment where I would say something such that it always provoked a certain kind of response where I was the butt of the joke. And then I'd press a button and it would flip to the next thing and it would reveal that I knew that was going to happen without going into detail. Basically that, it's the dumbest little joke. To me, I really look down on those kind of little tricksy, effectively prop gags. Not look down on them, but I've seen them done so well, I thought, I'm not going to be able to do something like that. I did that. I listened to the recording. The laugh lasted 28 seconds. That sounds like a short time. Let me assure you, that's the first time and only time in my life when I've had a 28-second laugh where people laughed. They laughed at the joke, then they laughed at what the joke meant, then they understood it, then it just rolled and rolled and rolled. So those things, you certainly want to go towards those. But I think with the vast majority of my stuff, it is about saying something true and listening for a laugh, which means it resonates. Because if it resonates, then you've got something to work with. If I say, have you ever felt like, I've got a bit of material about airports. This is a prime example of what I was talking earlier on. If I do my airport bit, will it make any sense? Because no one's going to airports anymore. You know, one of those concept things. But I'm going to joke about how when you arrive at an airport with which you're familiar, you feel like the man. You know where everything is, great. When you arrive at an airport with which you're unfamiliar, your resolve crumples and you're just like, should I just have my holiday in the airport? I don't know how it works. I don't know how this foreign place works. So I have that. So I have no idea whether at day one, I have no idea whether other people feel like that. So my job is to present it in such a way that it gives other people an opportunity to laugh at it, because if they're laughing, they probably recognize it. So if they do recognize it and they're laughing, that buys me some space within which to play around and try to flesh out the idea. And then by the 10th time I'm doing that routine, I'm saying, oh, maybe I should just lie down and die in the airport. I'm going to climb onto that machine, the little turny thing, and it puts the cling film around me, and I'll be all packaged up, ready to be buried in the airport. I all of that I will come up with on stage, because I've got enough of a laugh from them for the initial premise that now that I've bought myself some time to play around with it. So it's a means of sort of tricking myself psychologically into going, they're liking this, it's fine. What else can I do? What else can I breathe life into? So I'm listening for lots of things, but broadly speaking, the rule is if they're laughing, do it again. Or if they're laughing, do it more.
Yes.
You know, there's often one of the best notes you can give someone if you're helping them with their show or giving an outside eye on their show, is they'll do something, it'll get a laugh, and then they'll just move on. But are you mad? You've just made a room full of people laugh. This little aside that they all laughed at, that could be the start of 10 minutes. that could be the beginning of your Live at the Apollo routine, but you've just moved on away from it because we're desperate to go, what's the next thing? What's the next thing?
Yeah.
But taking the time to stay in it is important. But that's the thing. Adam Bloom, brilliant comic Adam Bloom, said years and years ago that it's, you can't do comedy without an audience. It's like trying to play the guitar by playing air guitar. Like the instrument isn't there. The audience are the instrument and you play them. So that relationship is absolutely fundamental.
Now with, you know, audiences, you know, not just in a live venue able to give feedback, whether it's laughing or heckling or booing, but, you know, with technology, people can provide comments at any time of day through social media or video. Mm-hmm. So be interested to hear what do you think are the pros and cons of that constant, almost the constant feedback fans and audiences are able to give comedians.
Yes. Well, I will say for my own part, my social media presence is hugely tied to my podcast. So mm-hmm. I do not like to use social media. I don't like to look at it particularly. I mean, I do a little bit, but in a vicarious way. I don't like to contribute to it. It wasn't around when I started comedy, and it was absolutely not why I got into the job. It's become a necessary part of it. So the way that I most like to use social media is I have a Facebook group for my podcast, which has 7,000 people in it. And I really enjoy that because that's a little walled garden in which I am king. And sure. What that doesn't necessarily do is it's not public facing, but it's community driven. And that's really my preoccupation for the podcast is I'm much more interested in creating art and creating a community than I am in being famous. So, you know, there are other comedians who are very much focused on famous and having a million followers on Instagram, and good luck to them. That's not me. So I know I'm after depth of engagement with a much smaller crowd, partly by need and partly by design. So, so some people who, you know, and to be honest, I've witnessed the effects of fame even before social media. I know comics are very famous and some of them like it and some of them loathe it. And I was famous in 2010. I was famous like man in the street spot, you know, getting recognized famous for about 2 weeks because of a TV show I did. And I did not enjoy the experience of that at all. So that's very like, it was kind of nice to begin with, but just a blanket person in the street knows who you are fame, I didn't enjoy. I think that is a kind of precursor to the sort of social media thing, whereby now lots of comics are very happy to treat their life as a reality show, to chop up and sell their every experience and put it online on Instagram and put filters and, you know, stickers and all the rest of it, and kind of invite everyone into the show, the special me show. That doesn't really suit me. I can completely see that it works for people. And sometimes the people who it really works for are people who either genuinely enjoy doing that. So there's no contrivance. They're just like, wow, I get to post a picture every 10 seconds. Awesome. And they like that. Good for them. Or people who are able to set themselves contrary to it. Someone like Ramesh Ranganathan, for example. Enormous profile. He's been doing, at the beginning part of lockdown, he was doing little Facebook Lives at lunchtime every day, where he's famous enough that he would just start doing it and he'd have 1,000 people watching. So he'd just take questions and comments. But his angle was always, this is pointless and I hate it and I can't be bothered with it. And that enables him to have a lot of fun with it without falling into the trap of that kind of needy social media desperation that we've all seen and that actually repels audience members. So the right attitude, I think, is really important. And you see it sometimes with, there's a fast food account. Is it KFC's Twitter in the States? I can't remember. There we go. Maybe it's not that successful because I can't remember the brand. But there are occasional social media accounts where they've clearly just said to their social media person, they've employed a comedian and they've just said, go nuts. So, you know, you've got the Wendy's account slagging off the KFC account or what have you, and they're being really funny. Those work because they are native to the internet. They're people who clearly care about the internet. And the thing is, people can smell a rat. Everybody can smell a rat. So in your branding and in your marketing, one of the best lessons I ever learned was don't try and talk to some sort of nebulous gray plasticine person called the customer. Try and talk to your friend Tony. Do you know what I mean? Like visualize a human being that you know and go, what would make Tony buy this watch I'm trying to sell? Or whatever, you know? Because if I just go, hey, watches are good, who cares? But if you could make Tony laugh, then he'd go, oh, go on then, sell me this watch. So those kind of interactions, I mean, we're talking about marketing there rather than necessarily interactions, although I do think one of the things that turns me off is when you can see artists maneuvering such that it is, this is a piece of my life, but really it's about selling tickets, hashtag like my fan page, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't go into that really at all. But the reciprocal, the responsive nature of Twitch that I have been really enjoying. And I'm now in a position with the Infinite Sofa, the chat show that I do, whereby I have, again, it's like a microcosm, not a microcosm. It's like the volume turned all the way up on this phenomenon I'm talking about, whereby I have about 150 fans of that show, of which 75, I'm worried they're going to get a tattoo because they are so hardcore fans. They are the most, they're the stickiest, most deeply engaged people. They make fan art. I've never had fan art before. They make fan art. They make gifs of me. They clip stuff of the show. Everything's an in-joke. I love it. Absolutely love it. The depth of the engagement is so much that I feel intertwined in their lives and I want to check in on them and make sure they're okay and stuff, you know. But but I think we're managing it in a good way, which is sufficiently engaged, but also enough at arm's length that it doesn't become weird. You know, yeah. It's like there's a thing we do whereby every time I mention on the show that we want it to be more inclusive, so it's like a horseshoe and not a circle. And they all start chanting circle, circle, circle in capital letters. So it's almost like this kind of body snatchers thing. So that is born of an incredibly responsive back and forth thing whereby I'm doing a TV show and everybody watching it in a chat stream down the side has the opportunity to disagree with me, pick me up on stuff, laugh at me, make fun of me, bully me. And it has become this phenomenal back and forth. It's just like you're attached to this pipe of just data into 150 people's homes and you're just glued to them. You're connected to them. It's exciting and exhilarating. And I'm trying not to say scary. It's almost a bit scary. Like it could be used in a scary way.
But I think it sounds like you've come to the right medium where you're able to, you know, just like at a live performance venue, you're allowed to walk off stage. So with social, you're allowed to sort of step away and not feel that pressure to.
Yes. And I actually, that's probably why I'm less into Twitter. I've had to delete Twitter during the pandemic or delete the app. I still use it via like Hootsuite, which means that I'm kind of at arm's length from it because sure. I can't be one of those people who just ends. I've got children. I can't, my time is too, I can't just sit on the sofa, get involved in an argument with someone on the internet or, you know, those kind of things. I don't have time for it. I don't want to do it. Sure. So I think it is. It is in tune with my values. What I want is to connect deeply with people. And you're only able to do that to much smaller numbers of people at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so that's my approach to it.
So this week there's been a lot of news when it comes to arts funding and supporting live venues. So the UK government announced an aid package to help UK arts and performance venues. And I think just this morning, the Live Comedy Association released a survey where they found that up to three quarters of comedy venues fear that they're going to sort of shut down in the next 12 months. So what do you see? Well, firstly, will we ever go back to normal, quote unquote, or will we have to adapt to a new normal when it comes to enjoying comedy live?
Yeah, I think I remain optimistic because I know that people will always need comedy, but then I'm remaining optimistic from the point of view of a white male middle-class comedian who's been going 15 years and has enough of an audience to stay afloat in some way or another. The biggest issue, and thank you for doing your research on this because it's so important. One of the many big issues is that comedy is never traditionally recognised as an art form. It's never funded. It doesn't appear on any, the people who are chopping up the whatever it is, 1 point something billion. None of them are thinking about comedy at the moment, which is what this SaveLiveComedy.co.uk campaign is all about from the Live Comedy Association. Although I remain optimistic that comedy itself will thrive, people will always need to meet in places and laugh at people. And those kind of things are fundamental. The danger is that hundreds upon hundreds of comedians lose their jobs. And the danger is that they're already very precarious jobs. And the danger is that it promotes only the most comfortable and secure comedians, very often white middle class people, often men. So the barriers to entry for some of the most vibrant and exciting and challenging youthful voices in comedy will become sky high, because already it's an enormous benefit to your comedy career if you've been to Oxford or Cambridge, not necessarily because those places hold the keys, although I'm sure you'd meet some valuable contacts, but because if you are going to Oxford or Cambridge, chances are you have parents who can afford to let you live rent-free at their place in London while mm-hmm. you do all your risk-taking and late-night driving. Maybe you don't need a job during the day. There are an awful lot of people who deserve to be comedians who will be hamstrung from doing that if comedy stops paying any money, you know, and it stops, because there's just so many things that could go wrong. It was already precarious. It was already flawed, but we within comedy were working to change it and make it better to a greater or lesser extent. At least that was, you know, we were having those conversations. But now I think it's really, really frightening. Almost half the industry have already given serious thought to leaving comedy because of the pandemic. That's like one of the stats from the Live Comedy Association survey.
Yeah.
Our mental health is already, as is everyone's, you know, in jeopardy. But that's a big part of it as well. And I think that, yes, I mean, if we can round off today with an exhortation for everyone to go to savelivecomedy.co.uk and read the full report and sign the open letter to the government to make sure that we are considered. I mean, if you think of the overheads, if you're a business producing comedy, or if you're Netflix, you need people to fill up that content for next to no money. It costs next to nothing to film a comedy show. The overheads are tiny. You really just need one person talking. You need costume and lights and you need a venue, sure. But you don't need a band. You don't need 20 people on stage, you know. So comedy gives an incredible amount, just purely on a mathematical, economical level. Comedy is so economically efficient for generating income. So it would be nice if the government reflected that it is of cultural value and economic value, as opposed to just sort of going, comedy's all right on its own, they'll do fine.
So aside from, comedy fans signing that petition, are there other actions that we can take to help support?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that anyone who is near a regular comedy club, somewhere which has its own premises and its own audience, if you're lucky enough to live near a glee club or a comedia, or Top Secret in London, or The Stand in Newcastle and Edinburgh and Glasgow, somewhere which has, I think those are in the most precarious position, the real grassroots comedy clubs. And similarly, if you are near, wherever your local comedy club is, even if you've only been there once or twice, go to their websites and find out what they're doing, because everyone is trying to do something during lockdown, whether it's online gigs, whether it's selling content that they've recorded at shows previously. Hot Water in Liverpool has done this massive move online. They've done a brilliant pivot there. As a member of the public, if you enjoy live comedy, go and support it. In the same way as I'd say, don't just stay in and watch Bill Burr on Netflix. Walk out the door and see, you know, whoever. See people you've never heard of. See Matt Ewings and Kima Bob and whoever. Because these people are going to be the next huge comics that you'll be pleased you can see them. Pre-pandemic, I'd have said, look, don't stick on Netflix, leave your house and go and see something. Now the same rules apply. Don't just see the big things that are happening. Actually seek out the comedy club near you and try and support it, because it will be doing something online in a pretty desperate and increasingly desperate bid to survive. The industry would just be decimated. If we lost the comedians in Bath and Brighton, and we lost the glees in Cardiff and Birmingham and what's the other one? I go to it all the time. It's gone. But, you know, those clubs are such a fundamental part of the British comedy circuit, and they occupy such an important place there. Not to mention the myriad other ones, which are a room above a pub, Always Be Comedy in West London. It's a phenomenal club, and it's just a room above a pub that happens once a week. But it won't be able to keep going, because the people running it and keep you going, you need acts to be on stage. You need new acts to consider it a viable career to come through and enliven the older acts. And you need the people who are running the clubs to be able to make a living from them.
Excellent. So some practical steps for all of us who enjoy comedy to really support our favorite comedians, new comedians, and comedy in general.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And thank you for being genned up on that, for having done your research on that, because that's gone really live today. It's just trending on Twitter, and we're really trying to make something happen because, you know, obviously trying to get comedians to unionize and take action is very difficult because we aren't an industry so much as a huge chorus of individuals, and it's like herding cats. But yeah, the Live Comedy Association are doing a fantastic job.
No, I mean, as you mentioned before, with the arts funding, it's, you know, a lot of that will go to more established places, the Royal Opera House, those, whereas the smaller, you know, houses where people start their careers or really hone their craft is not, you know, may fall through the cracks. So
yeah, and there are very, very few. There are rich people in comedy production, agents, managers, and so on, and your producers of TV shows. There are some, but there are not many of them. So when you see the person, you know, the guy who runs the Royal Albert Hall, what did I say on Twitter earlier on? The guy that runs the Royal Albert Hall was making an appeal to people to save his industry whilst they were doing a whip round to buy him a yacht as he moved on to his next job. You know, it's a real, you probably have to strike that from the record. I haven't got enough details on that to be able to make that. So it's a very nebulous thing. I agree with you. Yeah, we'll leave that there. I think you made the point already.
Okay. So I think we tackled quite a lot, but I just have a couple of quick fire questions that we ask all of our interviewees. So what is the last thing you recommended to a friend or a family member? Now, this could be a TV show or a new recipe.
Probably Succession, the TV show Succession. It is absolutely exquisite. And the fact that the third series is on hold because of the pandemic is, with all due respect to the pandemic victims all over the place, that's a really bad element of the pandemic. Oh, and actually, I tell a lie, the most recent, 10 minutes before this call, Feel Good, which is Mae Martin's sitcom, which is, I mean, the word sitcom doesn't do it justice, is extraordinary. It's up there with Fleabag and Game Face. It's just a brilliant, brilliant piece of work. That's on all four.
Fantastic. And finally, what are you a fan of that might surprise most people?
The Jack Reacher novels. It won't surprise them if they know me because I talk about them all the time, but the author Lee Child has done a series of probably 50 novels about a kind of lone wandering quasi-detective former military policeman. Tom Cruise was in the movies, which is hilarious because Jack Reacher only has one defining characteristic, and that's that he's very tall. I read them obsessively, and even when their quality varies wildly, but I'm absolute sucker for Reacher. Just love them.
So plenty of new recommendations for to watch and read. So Stuart, if people wanted to get in contact with you or follow you, what's the how would they go about doing that?
The trunk of the tree is comedianscomedian.com. I am on social media, often ComComPod, the Comedians Comedian podcast, but I'm not very good at any of those things. So you can follow me on there if you like, but go to comedianscomedian.com. You can find out all about the podcast. And then there's links there to find out about the Infinite Sofa. This chat show and my own stand-up.
Fantastic.
Well, and I should say, because there'll be business people listening to this, I also speak to business about resilience and what the greatest comics in the world can teach your business about resilience. And you can find out more about that at comedyinsights.com.
Yes, and I'm sure you're happy to discuss more of the online speaking opportunities as well.
I'm very excited. Just this morning we're going to start doing we did an experimental one, and we've had some interest to do a corporate version of the Infinite Sofa, which is so we do the show for 12 members of staff from an organization and then stream it to a private YouTube link for the rest of the organization with big name celebrity comedian guests, what have you. That's a really good I don't know quite what the term is. I'll have to learn for the pitch what the term is, but it's a really good way to bring staff who are furloughed and staff who aren't furloughed, but everyone who's working from home, and you know, it's like a staff party but during the day. So loads of fun.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Stuart, for joining me today, and I want to thank everyone for listening. Now please follow Distillery on our socials. We are at We Are Distillery. Stay safe, everyone. Wash your hands, and we look forward to welcoming you to our next episode soon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.